you know, by day I'm this flight instructor, college student kid. And then by night I'm like hustling sales and marketing jobs. And in my alter ego as a salesman, I found like a lot more people that were like rich, dumb, and happy. And I feel like in my highly educated aerospace friends, there was a lot of people that were like educated and miserable. Like they just didn't have control of their lives. And it just kind of dawned on me. I was like, you know what? I'd rather just be one of the rich, dumb, and happy people and maybe fly for myself one day.
Yeah.
Versus just being a pro pilot and flying for someone else. And it just kind of clicked at that time. And I finished my degree. I got all my ratings, but I just really felt like I wasn't supposed to pursue that career. And instead I went full time into a few different sales and marketing jobs post-college. And then that, if you do enough sales and marketing, you eventually go back to entrepreneurship, which is where I ended up. And so that's how I got there. So I have a very expensive education that I never really put to use in the marketplace, but all these years later, I did end up able to buy my own small airplane and put the flight training to use. And I do fly for my business.
What's up, boys and girls? We are back for another episode. We got Clint Fiore here. If you are on Twitter, you've probably seen him, especially if you're in the kind of entrepreneurship through acquisition. He is a business broker, M&A advisor, entrepreneur, death survivor in a more poignant way than most of us are. Clint, thanks for coming on, dude. I'm stoked to get into it. So I was listening to kind of your body of work in the podcast world. What was your kind of come up in entrepreneurship? You know, were you the kid selling rocks to the neighbors next door, or you were the like, I'm going to be a pilot, so I don't need to know entrepreneurship. And then that kind of shifted over time. How did you kind of come into it at a younger age?
I pretty much ran away from it at first. So like I had the typical kind of small business parent. So I was raised by a single mom who had a small business, and she managed a nursery garden center and also launched some retail stores. And so as a kid, I grew up working for the family small business, which mm-hmm. usually entailed long hours of manual labor and was not fun. And I kind of, you know, my mom didn't encourage me to go the business path. She really encouraged me to go the more traditional education, get a good education, get a good job path. And the way I got back to entrepreneurship was kind of funny. It was like, I was trying to put myself through a school, which was very expensive, to become a pilot, which was the career path I wanted to take. I just couldn't afford it, really, was the problem. It was a very expensive private university, but it was my number one choice. It was a top aviation aerospace school in the world. That's where I thought I needed to go to get the best education, to get the best job. And in order to pay my way through school, I discovered you could either work some crap job at the school library getting paid peanuts, or you could learn how to sell stuff. And basically, like, after my senior year of high school and all through college, I picked up sales jobs. And I started like, I did every sales job, all the classic ones, like door-to-door sales. I sold Cutco cutlery. I waited tables. I did telemarketing. And I just found out that I could make usually like 2 to 5 times more per hour selling stuff than I could just punch in a clock in a non-sales position. And I just kind of developed a well-rounded sales toolkit. But then that kind of snowballed into, you know, midway through school, I started getting into network marketing companies and team building and things like that. And I started making more money. And there was a time in college where I was probably making more money than my professors and a lot of my like peers that were even graduated in the workforce part-time doing like, you know, hustling network marketing or moonlighting gigs in college. Yeah. And then I started hearing back from the my peers above me. So the school I went to, about half of them are aerospace engineers and about half are pilots. And I was on the pilot track, and my pilot friends at that time, it wasn't a really strong job market. They were, a lot of them were on food stamps, flying regional jets, right seat, but not making hardly any money, didn't have any control of their time. And they liked airplanes and they liked flying like I did, but they just hated the job. And it was like ruining flying airplanes for them because they were making so little money, coming out with a big ton with a ton of student debt. And I just realized, like, that doesn't sound that fun anymore. Like, I love flying airplanes, but I don't know if I want to be this cog in the wheel in this big corporate airline structure, kind of climbing the ladder, when I've discovered I can make good money doing sales and marketing part-time. I was like, what if I was doing that full-time? And I just knew people in my sales line of work. So it was like, you know, by day, I'm this flight instructor, college student kid. And then by night, I'm like hustling sales and marketing jobs. And in my alter ego as a salesman, I found like a lot more people that were like rich, dumb, and happy. And I feel like in my highly educated aerospace friends, there was a lot of people that were like educated and miserable. Like they just didn't have control of their lives. And it just kind of dawned on me. I was like, you know what? I'd rather just be one of the rich, dumb, and happy people and maybe fly for myself one day.
Yeah.
Versus just being a pro pilot and flying for someone else. And it just kind of clicked at that time. And I finished my degree. I got all my ratings, but I just really felt like I wasn't supposed to pursue that career. And instead I went full-time into a few different sales and marketing jobs post-college. And then that, if you do enough sales and marketing, you eventually go back to entrepreneurship, which is where I ended up. And so that's how I got there. So I have a very expensive education that I never really put to use in the marketplace, but all these years later, I did end up able to buy my own small airplane and put the flight training to use. And I do fly for my business. And that's,
I mean, who doesn't have an expensive education that they basically did nothing with? I got a law degree sitting around here somewhere that I used for 9 months. Did that weigh on you from like an opportunity? Like, I know when I graduated law school, I kind of had this like axe to grind about going to school. I was kind of like this like anti-school stupid, like entrepreneurship. And I felt like I had wasted a lot of time being good at school. And now as time has gone on, I have a little bit more space. I'm grateful for it. Like, where do you place education or maybe like going to school K-12? Like, where does that sit in your relationship with your kids and how important it is, like how big of a focus it is with you and them?
Like, I have no regrets really of my education. I think it was a great time for me just to kind of grow up and get out of the house and find myself and find what I wanted to do, make lifelong friends and learn how to fly airplanes. And all that was like great stuff. And I don't think you have to just hit the ground at 18 years old, like firing on all cylinders as an entrepreneur in order to be successful. With my kids now, I take more of like a pragmatic approach of education's there if you need it for certain things, but it's more of like a tool that you can utilize and that it should serve your life's purpose and your life's goals versus the other way around. I feel like the way I was raised and a lot of probably our generation was raised is it's almost just like this given, like it's this checkbox.
Yeah,
it's the next thing you do.
Yeah.
But it's just kind of like an automatic assumption. If you're going to be successful, you got to get a good education. And, you know, I'm like, I want my kids to be successful, but I also think there's infinite ways to be successful. And so I think education is kind of a game that you have to play for certain things. And I'm teaching them that, you know, like this is a viable path for certain life paths you want to go down. But there's certain ways, there's certain goals and dreams that you have that don't require a college education. And if you want to pursue those, that's fine. But what I don't want my kids to do is just to do nothing. You know, like you got to do you got to make something of yourself. I don't want you to eke out an existence at a subsistence level. I want you to make your mark on the world and make something of yourself and challenge yourself and constantly be growing throughout your life and be learning throughout your life. And so for us, like we've chosen a homeschool. My oldest is 15 right now. And okay. So just getting into high school, but I've got four. For me, I really like homeschooling. Like I'm at my home office right now recording this podcast with you, and I'm doing multi-million dollar business transactions from this home office.
Yeah.
As well. And my life is a lot like my kids, with like, nobody wakes me up in the morning and tells me to get to work. You know, it's like, I live in this world where I can make as much money as I want, or I can make $0 or negative dollars. And it's up to me to like decide, what do I want to do? And we create some minimum standards in our home, but it's kind of up to them, you know, like how fast do you want to get through your high school to get into the college you want? Like I tell my teens, I've got two teen girls, like as soon as you're ready to do college, we don't have to wait till you're 18 to start college. Totally. You can start at 15, 14, whenever you want. We can enroll you in online universities and you can start getting credits. But life as an adult in today's world is self-paced. Choose your own adventure, decide what you want to make yourself into. And I feel like homeschooling is a lot like that. Whereas traditional schooling is more like show up when people say, do what people tell you to do, measure up to someone's somewhat arbitrary standards on what you're supposed to, you know, learn and know and do. Whereas the real world doesn't reward that so much. Like it's all about what you create. And so for me, that just feels right. It feels more like how the modern world actually functions. And so that's what we've chosen to do, but I'm not so into it that I say like, that's the only way or anything. Like if my kids really wanted to go to public school, we could have a conversation about it. We could do that. We give them the option, but so far they've really enjoyed kind of creating their own destiny as young people.
I know me growing up, I had to work a farm. Like my dad was a lawyer, but I worked on a farm. Like every weekend we'd go to the farm. And so I kind of viewed professional services as the way to get out of working at the farm, you know, like avoiding manual labor at all ways possible. I wanted a white collar job, which was typical. And with the whole like ETA crowd, the search funder crowd, where there's this whole generation of MBAs or college grads that are kind of like growing up with this idealized view of what being a small business owner, like I assume growing up in a nursery, like that's probably a prime target for an ETA, somebody who's coming out and, you know, has this like these rose colored glasses around what it looks like to own that business. Right. And it feels like the pendulum has swung where like small business 15 years ago was like, kind of like for like, you want to avoid it and you want to get super educated in order to avoid it. And now people are going to get degrees at Harvard, Stanford, and these best places in order to optimize for that. Where do you think that takes us over time?
No, it's wild to me. The whole ETA movement and starting to run into Harvard MBAs was like, it blew my mind because I had probably done several dozen transactions as a broker before I started even knowing what a searcher was. And
yeah.
And now it's like I've become well known in that community, but this was all happening without my knowledge, kind of on a parallel path. I left traditional schooling and big corporate work in order to pursue like startup entrepreneurship. And that was the world that I knew. And that's kind of the Wild West of raise an angel investor on your back of the napkin idea. And the first couple entrepreneurial things I did were like that, you know, just startups. I didn't know you could buy a business. I thought buying a business was something you could only do if you were already rich. And so for me, when I just had like student loans, $0 to my name, and I got the entrepreneurial itch and I wanted to leave my job and go start a business, all I thought you could do was do a startup. So that's what I did. And it wasn't until I had my first exit that I realized, well, maybe I have enough money now. I could go buy a business so I don't have to go through the pain of the startup process again. Maybe I can just find somebody that has one. And so I became a self-funded searcher before I knew what those words were.
Without knowing the term, yeah.
And I started encountering business brokers before I knew what M&A was or business brokerage was. I didn't even know that was a thing. I didn't know that was a profession. I never met a single one. So I'd started and sold a business as an entrepreneur, and I'd help raise another round of angel investment for another company, all before I encountered my first business broker. And so I wasn't aware of this world. And I bumped into it by accident, doing what I think a lot of your listeners do, which is you decide one day you want to try to buy a business, you Google it, buy a business, you end up on Biz Buy Sell or something. And, and then you just start encountering this Wild West ecosystem and trying to figure out heads or tails of what's going on. And it's kind of a mess. It's kind of an adventure. Yeah. But I was so frustrated by how difficult it was to get taken seriously as a buyer, to find good opportunities, just to, you know, even though I had an exit under my belt, I had some cash, I had some experience, I just couldn't find a good deal.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get a call back to save my life hardly. And it was so frustrating that that's kind of what was the impetus for me to get into business brokerage. Cause I was like, this sucks. These people suck. Like, I can shop for houses all day long in my pajamas and get 99% sure this is the house I want to buy, but I can't even get out of the starting gate with buying a business. And so I just thought, somebody needs to do this better. And me being still kind of young and cocky, thought I could do it better. I had no idea how hard it was going to be to try to improve this industry and how complicated it is.
And how long ago was the start of that? This was
2013. So it was like 10 years ago that I sold my interest in the manufacturing company I started. And then that put me on about a 1 year search journey where I was like, okay, I'm going to take 3 months off, just chill out, regroup after I sold my company and figure out what I want to do next. And then that turned into about a year of striking out. And then I decided in 2014 that I was going to go into the industry.
I sold my business by myself. Like, I talked to investment bankers. I talked to some business brokers. None of them really made sense to me. And it took 9 transactions because it was in different states. And so SBA buyers couldn't go across state lines. You had all of these issues involved with getting these things sold. And after I had sold them, I was like, the business, and I had money. I was like, it's so frustrating that I have money and I want to acquire another business, but brokers aren't returning my phone calls and it's impossible to get any deal done. And so my foray into it was like, I'm going to start a new marketplace where you can buy partial, you know, where like, you're not selling securities, but you're buying an active interest in all these people's businesses. So that was what the original version of Deal Maven was going to be. Cause I thought about it. It's just a very hard industry. And anyone who's brushed shoulders with it at all kind of sees the difficulty of it. And the stupid few, myself, you know, like the idea of changing that industry, like I've since waved the white flag and said, let's leave this to the people that can do, cause it's not going to be a quick process. And really, because most businesses, you know, it's different than real estate. Every business is its own story. You can't really underwrite it like an asset, like a piece of real estate, cause it's all so individualized. And so it's hard to match those things. Now that you've been in the industry for a decade, where do you sit on the conversation of like the silver tsunami and there, you know, there's all of this capital that's going to flow to, and all these assets that need to change hands into the next generation. And this is the greatest opportunity that exists, the greatest wealth transfer in history. Are you a bull on that? You think it's overhyped? Do you think it's upon us? It's 5 years out. What are your thoughts?
I think it's upon us, but it's hitting. The tsunami is not what people think it is. we were just talking on Twitter about Cabo San Lucas.
Yeah.
They have one of the most unique beaches in the world. In fact, most of the places in Cabo, you can't swim because you'll die. It's just dangerous. I don't know if you know that, but there's like a few swimmable beaches in this whole area of resorts. And a lot of the resorts you stay at, like they literally have people posted on the beach that they'll like tackle you if you try to get in the water, because you'll just get ripped out into the ocean.
Yeah.
The underwater topography is insane. It's basically immediately drops off deep. So you got these beautiful looking beaches and this beautiful blue water. But the second you get out into it, it's pretty violent rip currents and things, and you can just get pulled out into the ocean. They have to try to rescue you, and people drown and disappear. And so what the waves look like in Cabo is kind of,
that's kind the tsunami mean. That's upon us.
Yeah. You like don't see it at all. And then at the very last second it crashes because it's so steep. The beach is so steep. It just like hits, this little bitty wave hits and crashes hard at the very last second. And so I think people think it's going to be this like big wave they can ride, but most of it is like Cabo is like useless. It's the useless little wave is a bunch of self-employed boomers that don't have real sellable businesses, that are just the nothing burgers out in the water, that you can't really ride it. You can't really catch that wave. And the violent crash at the last little bit of the wave is everyone feeding frenzy for the ones that are sellable. And so I'm putting those like probably in the 5 to 50 employee companies that are doing like $500,000 to $2 million of earnings. Mm-hmm. That's where the violent action is of the tail end of that wave, where all the buyers want those businesses and nobody wants the one with 2 employees and $100,000 of earnings, which is a lot. That's probably the bulk of them. So yeah, like the wave is crashing, but it's just not this huge wave that everyone can ride. It's just a concentration in a very targeted like segment of the market. And that's where I kind of discovered that through trial and error of just when I was a new broker, I would take on like any size deal. Yeah. And I discovered like where all the action is over time. And I positioned my firm to try to like ride that little piece of the wave. Like I'm not trying to be the solution to everybody. I'll let everybody else list the really tiny ones. And then I'm also not going to go compete with Goldman Sachs in, you know, middle market private equity deals. And like, but I think there's this kind of sweet spot that's at the very top of Main Street and very lower middle market where the best deal activity is happening. And where I've tried to position myself is just be right in the middle of that violent action of where everybody wants to be and the deals are hard to come by and there's lots of action on them, and just build the trusted brand in that space that basically only represents stuff that I would want to buy if I was a buyer, because I've been a buyer and I was shopping for deals there.
Yeah.
And so that's been our formula, is just try to be quality representation in that narrow slice of the market where everybody wants to play and be the most trusted voice in that space. That's what I've been trying to do for the last so many years. And, that formula has been working for us.
Do you feel like on the buy side of the table that the proliferation of buy a business, no money down, you know, boring businesses are the new wave, that there's been all these people that have made a mint on selling the information on how to buy these, you know, previously kind of unpurchasable businesses. Do you see a lot of buyers buying things that they shouldn't?
Yeah. I mean, I think the influencers that have sold that dream have done a good job of kind of like introducing the masses to the concept.
Yeah.
But it almost backfires because there's almost too many people that are fighting for the same deals. And the ones, the most popular content to sell is talking about how I did this deal 100% seller financing or this or that. And if you fill up someone's head with that idea, me, I've been a sell side broker most of my career in this space for 8 or 9 years. And I've done a couple of seller finance deals that were 90-100%, but by and large, most of them were not, you know, like most of them, a bank was involved because we're doing good deals that are making good money and they're bankable. And the seller looks at you and the broker looks at you like you're an idiot. If you want to, if you ask for 100% seller financing there, it's just like a red flag. Like why?
For sure.
Like, why can't you get a bank? It makes you look like a loser. Cause it's like, why do you want me to be your bank when a bank could be the bank, you know? And, and so we do seller financing on most deals, but it's usually like 10 or 20% of the 15, deal.
Yeah.
And so I'm going around, and this is what I think has endeared me to Twitter a little bit over the last year and a half. I was kind of new to the show. I just joined in 2022, but I felt like there weren't a lot of brokers on there that had like real sell side deal experience, but there was a whole lot of buyers, and there was a whole lot of buyers and influencers selling the dream to buyers. And I kind of came in a little bit like a wrecking ball of like introducing a reality check and saying like, here's how it's really happening. For someone that's in the arena, to use the overused term of the week, in the trenches. And I would write threads, you know, like teaching about what a good deal looks like, what a bad deal looks like, what a good broker looks like, what a bad broker looks like, what a good buyer looks like, what a bad buyer looks like, you know, just stuff like that. And, but just street smart teaching. And that's what really, I think, has helped me kind of blow up on social media. It's just almost being like the tough love.
Totally.
With a sense of humor, like reality check to what's going on, because people need to know the real story as to what's really happening and not just the idealized version of it.
I've been more and more exposed to like internet marketing just through my wife's fitness business and needing to like working on how to message something properly to get people excited about a product in a way that we never had to do in brick and mortar entertainment. I assume in nursery too, like you don't need to spend a lot of time copywriting or like, you know, selling a dream to people about what it's going to look like when you get your plants for your backyard. But in the internet marketing, obviously the digital space, I think it's such a hard line to draw between, you got to get people excited about the future or else they do nothing. So you have to let them see what's possible. And there has to be the other side, which I think you fit very well, of like knowing what's possible, but then you also have to bring that down to like what's likely. And also you can get yourself in a lot of trouble, even on a no money down deal. Even if you put no capital in, like there are plenty of businesses that are worth less than zero. And if you're signing on leases or notes, or, you know, you're taking on debt in an assignment role, you can still lose your shirt, even if you get in. And that was one of my first messages online. Was I was so frustrated about the like the prospect of no money down stuff, because there's hidden risk there that most people aren't sensitive to and they're not thinking through. And also when you go out into the market with the expectation of I only want something that costs no money, like the sorting mechanism that you're putting over the market is going to only get you bad deals. Almost exclusively.
Exactly. Yeah, because the good deals, people with money will go buy them. And the brokers will put them at the front of the line. You know, like when we're talking to buyers, any broker worth their salt, you know, we're asking about their source of down payment right off the bat. We're figuring out if this person has the financial wherewithal to close the deal. And just because something is theoretically possible at 100% leverage or 90, 95% leverage, we know from experience, it takes a lot longer and is a lot more risky to try to close a deal like that than someone that has 30% to put down.
Yeah.
It's a huge difference. Every bank in the world wants to do that deal, and they'll do it much more quickly. And me as the broker, I'm not just trying to get the highest purchase price, which is what I think trips people out a little bit, is I think brokers key in on surety to close and speed to close more than they
top dollar amount.
Yeah, more than the top dollar. Because ultimately we get paid to close deals, not to get LOIs that look really good but can't close. So we become kind of like heat seeking missiles to, you know, when we have two offers in front of us and we're talking to our client and say, hey, this one's a little bit more, but we think this is going to take longer and maybe 50-50 if this even closes. And this one, sure thing. Like,
yeah,
this one's going to happen. Like, we're going to take that one. And so I think if I could correct a misconception out there on the, if I could step on my soapbox about the $0 down thing, is you can do a deal with zero down, but the right way to do it isn't asking for it all from the seller. You need to convince an investor to be your partner. And I think that is the winning structure today. Because if you're trying to get it all from the bank and the seller and you don't have any skin to put in the game yourself, what's going to happen is you're going to get beat, especially if you're trying to buy a nice deal, like where that wave is crashing in that intense space of like $500,000 to $2 million of EBITDA earnings. Like, there's a lot of people with real money that are fighting for those deals, and you're just going to get left behind and you're going to be left at the altar, you know, so many times missing out, watching other people close the deals. And if you truly have what it takes to run a business, you've got the skills, you've got the wherewithal, the credibility to be a great, you know, CEO, GM, operator, whatever you want to call it, then in this environment, capital is one of the easier things to come by, because there's more people that have money on the sidelines that want to invest in deals than there are people that are wanting to roll up their sleeves and run the small businesses. And so instead of trying to sell yourself to a seller in a competitive marketplace that you're the special snowflake that deserves to have 100% financed their company, like, you should convince some investors that you're the right person for the job and structure the deal to where you retain a majority stake by signing up for the SBA debt and then sell a minority interest or a couple of them to investors to secure the down payment, so that then you have a chance of actually getting a yes to your LOI, getting your deal closed, and getting it done that way.
I get the occasional investor pitch where someone's wanting to go and be the operator. And I did a tweet about this the other day, I'm okay if the operator puts no money, like the money doesn't have to be substantial, or the skin in the game doesn't have to be substantial. It just has to be substantial to them. Like, even if you put no money in, you have to find some way to have to absorb whatever downside may occur in the business. And I think people have, they're trying to make it heads I win, tails you lose type deals where you know, and just nothing ends up happening. You end up wasting time because you have to find the thing that you're willing to risk something for if you're asking other people to risk their risk capital. And I think you can probably get dumb money that way, you know, just friends and family. If here's 25 grand, here's 50 grand, cause I have it, hopefully it goes well. But if you want someone who is, you know, somewhat that can be helpful in the process, and when things aren't going well, you can call them on the phone and have them tell you something that can be helpful. If everyone has skin in the game, then the answers just end up being better, you know?
Yeah. And skin in the game isn't always cash. It can be
totally,
I'm leaving a lucrative career and moving my family across the country, signing up a personal guarantee on a loan. And, you know, I had to sell my wife and kids on this whole thing and risk, like, that's massive skin in the game. Like, you're taking some major personal and reputational risk and financial risk. Expecting to get into a deal where you retain a majority interest and take virtually no risk is pretty much a pipe dream for most.
It's just a waste of, time, right? I'm sure a lot of the deals, you close them and everyone goes on their merry way and it all works out great. I wanted to know of some of the horror stories, if any, that you have, you know, just whether bad deal structure or asset loses its value, you know, some of the, at least I found in my life, all of the wins that I've had, it's like, you know, I don't really know, you know, there's a whole confluence of events that are helpful and it's hard to really pinpoint it. But the times that I've had massive losses, I'm like, I know exactly what I did wrong there. So I thought it'd be good to hear a little bit of like just things that you've seen where things have gone off the rails and some learnings from it. Today's episode is brought to you by the Exit Operating System. If you run a business right now and you are thinking about selling it one day and you want to know what you should focus on in order to maximize your exit value, go to exitos.io and sign up now. Peace.
Yeah, I mean, I have some really sad horror stories, some from deals we brokered and some from just I catch the aftermath of bad deals. Yeah. Because a lot of times people do a bad deal and they get screwed over and they call a business broker to try to bail them out.
Sure.
You know, like, I bought this business, I'm losing my shirt, I'm about to go bankrupt, can you sell my business? And right. We get that call, you know, and cause their friend, they tell their friend at their wit's end, hey, I'm about to lose everything cause I made this bad business deal. And they'll be like, call Clint. He sells businesses. He'll help you out.
Yeah.
You know? And so I get those calls. So I do have, just disclaimer, is over 90% of deals that we've ever brokered or represented are all have happy endings.
Yeah.
And they pay their debts off. They're no regrets. Great decision. But there's a single digit percentage of just absolute shit shows that happen. Yeah, sometimes.
Dumpster fires.
Yeah, if I could say that word. Dumpster fires,
yeah, no.
Probably more appropriate.
Oh, yeah, we cuss here.
Okay, great. So I'm happy to tell you some stories. I mean, the saddest one was we had a guy take his life. And it was crazy. I mean, that's the worst it can get. And anyone out there listening, you know, I'd say, like, if you're ever having those thoughts, which a lot of entrepreneurs do, we have suicide rates that are probably 3 times higher, I think, than non-entrepreneurs, that, like, you know, you can always come back from financial stuff, you know,
right.
but you gotta, like, go into these things, letting yourself sit in if the worst happens, you know, like, you have to let yourself imagine it, you know, like, I may face personal bankruptcy if this business goes under and I've personally guaranteed a bunch of debt I can't afford to pay off. That's your worst case financial scenario, but you can recover from that. And you can live to try again. And so, but yeah, like, the one time we had that result, it was a deal I took over from another broker that was struggling to sell this company. And that was kind of its own red flag that I probably shouldn't have gotten involved. But it was this lady that I was friends with in Dallas that took on a listing in West Texas. It was like a moving and storage company. And it was kind of overpriced. It was small. And what most of the tragedies have in common is they're usually, like, small deals with buyers that have no business buying them, that they're kind of stretched to their max and putting every last dollar into buying a small deal, but you have, like, very little margin for error.
Right.
And all of a sudden you've got debt on you. And yeah, we just basically helped close this deal and found a buyer that could do it, adjusted the price down a little bit to where it could, like, barely fit the SBA box, and got it done. But it was just maybe like a $500,000. But I think what ended up happening was it was kind of the snowball of this person moved their family out to a new place where they didn't have any support. Something happened with the business. They just didn't run it as well as the previous owner. And it was razor thin anyways to meet, you know, right. to meet the obligations. They were kind of betting on that they could do it better, and they didn't do it as well. And I think it was the stress of not having support structure, maybe the spouse not being on board with the whole thing, and, you know, the promises made that are now going sideways. And yeah, I get a call from the banker saying, "Hey, have you heard from so-and-so?" And I'm like, "No, I haven't heard anything." 'Cause we move on, you know, brokers move right. on down to the road, the next deal. And then, yeah, it's like they were missing payments and being non-responsive. And I called the seller, and the seller hadn't heard from them. And it was just like, yeah, we don't know what's going on or where this person is. And then I got a call back later that they had ended their life. And so, like,
this was the new buyer that kind of came in this distress and yeah. bought it.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's thankfully the only time I've seen a suicide in this industry, but I mean, I'm 8 years in, and hopefully that's the only one I'll ever see. But that was early in my career, saw that. And that really gives you a gut check as a broker that you're like, man, this is kind of life and death stuff. Like, this is serious decisions being made, and it makes you really feel the weight of it when yeah. you're a transaction advisor of like, and that's always been what I try to do anyways, is like, would I want my friend or family member to do this deal? On either side.
Yeah.
You know, would I tell them to move forward if I was in their shoes, or if I was counseling a friend or family member? And I'm a dreamer. I'm an optimist. I always see, you know, like the world through rose colored glasses, because I believe in myself, and I believe I can get into almost any business and make it win. Because what am I? I'm a salesman, right? I was trained in sales yeah. and marketing. A good salesman. That is something that most successful buyers have in common, is like, a good salesman can come into almost any business and sell their way to success. But if someone comes in, they don't have the ability to kind of like rainmake and make stuff happen, then they can get into a situation in a declining sales environment to where they just feel powerless, you know, and they just feel like they're in front of a steamroller getting run over. And
so. That's such a huge piece of it. Because a lot of I know I went to law school, and I tried to go to the best law school possible, basically as a way to avoid selling ever, you know, and I'm sure a lot of people, you go to Harvard or Stanford, or you go to the best MBA program that you can go to. So that way you can never have to sell anything ever. I think the two pieces that are interesting, like when I was pricing law in Manhattan, whether Blackstone lost 50 mil or 100 mil on a deal, like, no one's killing themselves. You know what I mean? Like, it's mm-hmm. at the institutional level, it's just, there's something that's completely impersonal about it. And so there's something that's nice about that. It's just professional, and it's just massive organizations losing a little bit of money or making a little bit of money. And that totally gets stripped away when you move down to the SMB level, and it's all interpersonal, and you know these people, and it can massively change the trajectory of somebody's life, to the benefit side or to the detriment side. But when a lot of people are going into business acquisitions, if you're doing it as a way to avoid having to sell ever, you know, or thinking that you're not going to have to deal with customers or deal with employees, then you're in for a rude awakening. And like, I mean, that even happened even as we were running our trampoline parks. Yeah, there was just like, learning sales is such a massive skill that I feel like a lot of the Ivy Leaguers kind of look down on as kind of blue collar work. And it's really the thing that unlocks everything. And it's the work that has to get done in order to really drive value in any of these deals that you're looking at.
I'll tell you an example, and this is a word of warning and opportunity, okay, for the buyers out there. A lot of times you'll see a deal that's got 1 to 3 million of revenue, and a million or more is flowing through the owner's cell phone. Like, sure. If you just hang out with the owner for the day, like, their phone's ringing, and it's people that are asking that are kicking off a sales process, and their initial fielding of these high value calls is so dialed in and good that they can, it's like, they don't even know how they're so good. They've just been doing it for so long. They're just good. And if you come in as a searcher thinking that you can just fill out shoes, or if you're not going to fill those shoes, I'm just going to hire someone for that. Like, never, ever outsource your sales rainmaking function to a new hire, or fully rely on the seller to keep delivering that, because like, that can be sometimes 50%. It can be sometimes 90 or 100% of the revenue stream is coming from that seller's personal sales effort. And this can work for you, or it can work against you. So then the negative side, how it can kill you, is obvious. You know, the seller goes away, they get their bag of money, and they take their cell phone with them, and nobody wants to call your Google phone number you just set up anymore. They wanted to talk to Jim, the guy they trust, and there goes all your revenue, and it takes a long time to recover from losing the top rainmaker. Or sometimes it's an employee that holds you hostage, and the second you buy, they realize they've got all the leverage and they want to double their salary, or they want a piece of equity because they know they're the top rainmaker. You know, like, stuff like that happens. But I've seen two examples of those exact scenarios working in a buyer's favor. So we did a deal on a tree service business. This was probably $1.5 million revenue, $500,000 in earnings. So very good margin company. And the phone number was the owner's cell phone. And the owner answered their phone 24/7, bid every bit of work. And he had the crews that actually climbed the trees and did all the work. But he was the one and only phone answerer and salesman for the thing. And we knew that going in, and we knew that we couldn't get a very high multiple because of that. It was like really wrapped around the owner. The buyer ended up being a business development guy for Wells Fargo. Mm-hmm. And he was a salesman, but white collar. Yeah. But he put himself through school doing landscape work. He'd knocked on doors. Like, I believed this guy could potentially fill the shoes of the seller in a pinch. But the way we structured the deal kind of gave us two levels of protection. We did it to where it was a huge part of this deal was seller finance. The seller finance was contingent on hitting certain revenue targets. The seller actually liked the sales part of the job, but he didn't really like running the crews and managing the work and stuff like that. And so we told him, the buyers are going to immediately take that off your plate, and you're going to no longer answer your phone after hours. Like, so you're going to have sanity again, because he hated answering his phone during his kid's volleyball game and stuff like that. And so we're like, hey, Mr. Seller, we're going to get you your dream job. You're just going to do the part of your job that you like in hours that are workable for you to have a nice lifestyle. We're going to take after hours calls off your plate. The buyer's going to answer those. And then you're going to get all this seller finance money with a good interest rate, as long as the revenue stays up the level it currently is or better. So we structured that all into it. And then we had a buyer that, if he needed to, could bounce from his job at Wells Fargo and fill the shoes if he needed to. So we kind of had like the seller as first line of defense in his dream job, and then the buyer is backup. So we had kind of redundancy there. And that deal went so well, the seller ended up loving working for this buyer, that the buyer didn't have to immediately leave his job. He bought more trucks, started more crews, and started doing more marketing, and added another salesman, and kind of like doubled up the business infrastructure. And the seller's making as much money as they were making owning the business, just selling part-time for a commission, loving it. Yeah. And so he worked there for several years, and the buyer was able to double, triple up the company in just a couple short years with the seller's help. So it's all about like structuring the deal right and just facing those things. And so a lot of buyers pass on that deal because they're like, oh, that's not a business. That's just somebody's job. You know, like they get real uppity in their attitude about it. And they think like, that's not legit. But this guy bought this business for $1 million, about a 2x multiple of the 500K earnings. And it's easily worth $3 or $4 million today. And it's paid off all of its SBA debt. It has, you know, more crews, more trucks. Every time I talk to him, he's just adding more and more. But he took it to that next level. He took it to where it was not just the owners as the main rainmaker with a support structure of the field laborers around him. He took it to that professionally managed organization that can now scale. But yeah, good deals can be had, but you have to be able to face the hair on them, right? You have to be able to like know what the issue is. And so for me as a broker, I think a bad way to be a broker is you try to pretend, you just show the financials of that company and go, ooh, ah, look at how much money it's making. Get in here and you're going to make even more. Like I face that head on and I say, look, the numbers look great, but I priced it low for a reason. All the calls go to the cell phone. This guy's not going to change. You're going to have to like be ready to get in there and fill these shoes. And it's not going to be easy because he's really good. He's really experienced. And we're pricing this so it could survive a bit of a downturn if you lose the seller and have to, you know, try to learn as you go here. And so for me as a broker, I try to be upfront with the worst things about the deal. I try to price that stuff into the asking price. And so like, I'll say, this is why we are only asking a 2X instead of a 3X here. Because if he had not made this mistake as an operator, we could get him a 3 or 4 probably. But we address all that upfront. And a lot of the best deals are, if you can stop demanding the perfect company and realize there's almost no small businesses that are perfect, that are like, you know, no owner involvement. Yeah. Like all recurring revenue contract. Yeah. You know, like everybody has their wish list of everything they wish were the attributes of these companies. But a lot of these good profitable companies, like they just don't meet your wish list. But if you can get one that's got like most of your wish list, but it's got one big thing wrong with it, but you can price it accordingly and come up with a plan to mitigate the risk of that one thing, then that sometimes those are the best deals you can make. Every time. No, I've had to set rules. So, yeah, so I knew going in, I was self-aware enough because I'm like a serial entrepreneur before I'm a business broker. I knew I was going to fall in love with every deal and want to chase doing my own deals. And so I set like a set of rules and I've stuck by them for the last 8 or 9 years. And I'm actually starting to evolve them to be even more narrow and focused. But the main rules I live by, because I do want to buy every single one. Like I think that's what makes us a good brokerage, is we only take on stuff that we want to buy. And everyone that works with me on my team, we all love these businesses. And we are all just like, oh, I wish I could buy this, but got to follow the rules, you know, and we kind of stick to it. But I do participate sometimes. But basically the number one rule I made was I looked myself in the mirror and realized I'm Clint Fiore. I am not Elon Musk. I am not capable of running a bunch of companies. I don't know how that guy does it, but I'm not that guy. Like I couldn't run Tesla and SpaceX. I couldn't run, you know, like one of those, much less, you know, 4 or 5 or however many he's running as the CEO. And so I read, you know, I read a ton of business books. One of my favorite books I've ever read in business was called The One Thing by Gary Keller. I love that book. The very beginning before you start reading it is the Russian proverb is like, he who chases two rabbits catches none. And it's just basically, you know, focus on the one thing, is the theme of that book. It's a great book. If you haven't read it, really quick, easy read, but I decided I'm only going to let myself run one company at a time. And that company is my brokerage. If the only way I would leave, I would buy a company where I had to run it is if like my brokerage was at a point where it didn't need me at all anymore, or I had sold it or something like that. But I'm not allowed to like try to run two companies at the same time. So that was like my first rule. And so that limits a lot of opportunities. So that makes me, I feel like I'm an early pioneer in the minority investment kind of structure that's becoming popular now on SMB Twitter and beyond, which is like, yeah, we're getting more and more deals with that structure. But I kind of started doing it almost by accident. So I had a couple deals. Like one was a barbecue restaurant and smoked meat store in the middle of nowhere, Texas. I loved. A friend of mine was the buyer. It was like a guy I knew from church that was really passionate about meat. And it's this place had this huge smoker, made awesome jerky, cut steaks, made barbecue. It was this awesome. It was called King's Texas Smokehouse in Camp Wood, if you want to look it up. But yeah, my friend ended up buying it, and he had like just enough money to get into it, but I think he needed like a little bit more operating capital, and the bank kind of drew a line where they're like, you know what, we don't want you to be too thin on this. We want you to have a little bit more down payment. And it happened to be like close to what my commission was going to be on the deal. And I was just like, you know what? I love this store. I love this guy. I'm just going to like, I think it was about my 10th deal I've ever done. And I was like, I viewed it as almost like a tithe or something. Like here, I'm going to just give my 10th deal to the deal gods and like put my commission into the equity structure of this deal and get it done and then go along for the ride with this guy. And I helped him kind of like get into that deal and then get another location later. But I became a minority partner, and he put, there's the Clint burger on the menu, which was the biggest perk of doing the deal. I got a burger named after me. But I did stuff like that. Like I bought into that one. I bought a bookkeeping company that I rolled into my brokerage for a while, and then I ended up splitting back off and sold off this year. But a lot of the deals were kind of like opportunistic. They were just, okay, there's a funding gap. It would be easier for me to just fill this gap and get the deal done and move on with my life and hope for the best than to keep trying over and over again and striking out to find the perfect buyer that's not coming in on this. You know, so I would kind of like opportunistically invest, but that's not the right way to invest. It's really not. It was just kind of like a means to an end at times. And so as I've matured and learned and participated as a minority partner on some deals, I've started to raise my standards. I've started to think more strategically, and I start to narrow in on what my criteria is on when I will push in chips into a deal. And I share that with my leadership team. And it's like, we all know my playbook and my appetite. And right now I'm happy if I do a participation on about one or two deals a year. And I typically now want them to be of a certain size. I kind of have a whole list of criteria, but it's getting more and more strict as our deal flow has increased. The opportunities we look at have increased, and I will participate, but it's now I feel like I'm doing it strategically instead of opportunistically. And I've just been learning from, I'm really learning a lot from my clients. That's one of my favorite things about this industry, is both, you know, buyers end up being our clients too, because most buyers come in unrepresented even when we're sell side. And so we end up kind of like helping the buyers get their financing, get their ducks in a row. And we serve as intermediary where we're kind of working on both sides of the deal. And so I consider the buyer and the seller my client, you know, when we're working, even if we're engaged sell side. And there's just really smart people that have done, every time I watch a deal happen and participate on one as an advisor, I pick up a new trick, I pick up a new tool for the toolkit. And I think that's going to make me a better investor. And so, yeah, I'm one of the few brokers out there that kind of eats their own dog food or like participates in deals. It's like the one thing every broker tells you when you first start is like, don't fall in love with the deals, don't invest, don't buy businesses, just make your money and move on. And I've never really liked that philosophy. I feel like I know a lot of real estate people that are brokers, and they, you know, they're in residential real estate because they're building a residential real estate investment portfolio as their primary method of wealth building. There's commercial realtors that do the same thing in commercial real estate and multifamily. But like, why can't I do that in business brokerage? Well, I found out because it's hard if you don't do it right. But I think if you get the formula right and you learn the minority interest protections you need, the criteria, and you stick to your guns and you follow your own playbook, that I do think it can be a great wealth building vehicle. And it still is my number one thing I invest in is small businesses. Yeah, so I came from angel investing originally, and so I knew equity. But as I've learned, yeah, like I'm really starting to like the giving my money back with preferred return, and then I get an equity kicker in perpetuity, and then I'll just cheer you on and help you out however I can. But now I've got my capital back to go roll into the next deal. And you can accelerate the amount, the quantity and quality of deals you do by getting that capital returned to you, because most of the opportunistic equity investments I made just remain illiquid for an unreasonable amount of time. And it's no fun, you know, like just year after year. Yeah. 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 For me, it was almost just scratching an itch. Like I love teaching. I love speaking and teaching and writing. And I didn't really have much of an outlet for that. And I think this applies to business brokers as much as any profession. If you just take, what's the coolest stuff you've learned in your career that, you know, you go to a party and people are talking about sports and other stuff you don't give a crap about, and you're like, man, I wish someone would ask me about this one thing that I know more than anyone else on the planet about. But like, no one gives a crap in your house party about your nerdy, specialized knowledge that only you know, unless it's just a sliver of humans in your physical circle, at your circle of friends, at your church, at your school, at your communities, actually give a crap about what you've spent a decade becoming a master at. But when you go to the internet and you go to social media, all you need is a sliver of the population that vibrates at that same frequency and like loves your nerdery and mastery of what your craft is. And you just put your best stuff out there. And so what I did is I just came into Twitter with no expectations. I'm just going to give everything away. Like every best piece of nugget and hard won lessons and bruise and victory and triumph and tragedy or whatever. I'm just going to tell stories and teach everything I've learned. And if nobody ever hears it, it's just going to be at least an outlet for me. Cause like, this is a dramatic business. It's very emotionally difficult and just, it's cathartic a little bit to just tell stories and write it out. And like every deal has drama and drama is compelling and drama is educational and people want to hear about it. And so I respect confidentiality. I think brokers are always worried about like, oh, you can't talk about it because confidentiality. Well, like I just don't use real names and I don't use identify, but I'll tell the stories of the hard lessons and I'll teach the best things I've learned. And if that little sliver of the world that gives a crap about what you're an expert in finds it, you're going to blow up. And so that's my biggest advice on social media, whatever it's videos, podcasts, Twitter, whatever is like, what are you a master at? If you're like a master at business brokerage, don't go on there talking about politics. No one gives a crap about your opinion on Donald Trump or whatever. Like stick to what you know and put your best stuff out there and think of the listener. How can I make the person who reads this life better? How can I make them give them something they can actionably use to improve their life or at least make them laugh or make them a little better? And if you put yourself in the shoes of your listener, put your best stuff out there and just try to like give tremendous value, expecting nothing in return, you're going to get massive returns on that. And that's what I feel like has happened to me in the last year is huge returns have come back from just leading with that example. Yeah, but I mean, I'm just launching into video, so pretty much on all the socials. But Twitter's my biggest, Facebook, LinkedIn are my second and third. But I'm getting onto Instagram, TikTok, and all that as well. But most everywhere, my handle is my name. It's Clint Clint Fiore Fiore, and then my company name is Bison Business, and our website's bisonbusiness.com, and that's where you can sign up for our deal notification newsletter to get early notified of deals we bring to market or for any of our like buy side services, which we do offer a search program for those that want to find an off market deal. We launched that recently. And then we also do buy side advisory as well. So whether you're buying or selling, searching, we want to be a great resource for you. And we're based in Texas, but we can do deals all over the country as advisors. Awesome, man.